Renu, how are you?
I'm good. Still on a bit of a high after you, Sans. It was a fantastic meeting.
Yeah.
And, sad to almost come back, really. But back to reality.
Yes, so we're back from USANS. We've posted a few podcasts since then, but there's still a bit of a tail end of USANS, if you like, going on, isn't there?
Yeah, no, I mean, it was a fantastic meeting and always so good to reconnect with all our friends and colleagues and some fantastic international guests this time.
So today we're very happy to welcome one of those international guests into the studio, a friend of ours from Germany, first time in Australia as well, Professor Axel Merseberger from Lübeck in Germany. Axel, thanks so very much for not just coming for USANS, but for staying on for a few days and coming to see us in
GUCAST. Welcome to Melbourne.
Thanks a lot, Renu. Declan, it's been a pleasure. It was a great conference. I mean, just the hospitality, the scientific content, it was just unbelievable and a role model for all other conferences, I would say. Thanks for having me here.
I just can't believe that it's your first time in Melbourne, because it feels like you're so familiar amongst urologists in Australia.
Virtually.
That's true.
What have been some of your highlights of the meeting?
Definitely, like, it's the combination. You had the chance to look at, like, andrology. You had highlights with penile prothesis, where Faisal, for example, showed his experience. Then we had Professor Stenzel, Arnulf Stenzel, showing, like, the recent developments in artificial intelligence and large language.
That was a fantastic talk.
It was great.
Yeah.
And planary, and prostate cancer, bladder cancer, kidney cancer. So, like, all the topics and really up to date. And what I liked a lot, you had quite unique titles and you challenged the speakers with, for example, EMBARK trial.
Yeah.
How is a patient embarking at you or something like this? It was quite unique. Right? Is your patient hormone and sensitive?
That's right. That was your talk.
That's my talk.
So. Yeah, absolutely. Hormonal and sensitive.
Hormonal and sensitive.
Yes, fantastic.
So no, Axel, it was a great talk. Has offered to stay around for a few days. You're on a speaker tour with Janssen Pharmaceuticals, who are one of our gold partners here on the podcast. They've been with us since the very start, actually.
Yeah,
they've been great.
They've been a huge supporter of ours.
And this podcast today is one of our themed podcasts in association with Janssen. So yes, we still have Axel, courtesy of them. And our topic today is going to be, we're going to talk about two different areas, really. First, and is metastatic hormone-sensitive prostate cancer. We talk about that a lot, but it does move very quickly. And while we have a world-leading expert in the management of metastatic hormone-sensitive prostate cancer, we're going to pick Axel's brains for a few minutes about how he approaches this in 2024 with AR pathway inhibitors now becoming more and more widely available around the world. And second, high-risk prostate cancer. This was very topical at the USANS meeting. It's bound to be again at EAU in a few weeks' time. So we want to talk to him about staging these patients, neoadjuvant data that's emerging for high-risk prostate cancer, and so on. So please stick around for that as well.
Because he still is a surgeon.
He sure is. Yeah, exactly right.
He's such an expert on, you know, metastatic hormone-sensitive and all stages of prostate cancer, really, that we sometimes forget that you're a surgeon at heart.
You have the Hugo.
You have a Hugo robot as
that's
well.
Right.
Yeah,
yes.
Because you are the chief and professor of urology in your department. So you have to run the whole department as well as do a busy clinical practice.
It's a team, as always. It's always good to have reliable team.
Very good. Absolutely. So let's kick off a bit, Renu, and ask a bit about metastatic hormone-sensitive prostate cancer. I think the two first questions I would have would be about staging of these men in the era of novel imaging. Mm-hmm. I mean, we never get bored of it. It's never not without controversy. Should we be using PET? What does it mean? You know, high volume, low volume, things you see on a PET scan that you don't see on a normal scan, et cetera, et cetera. But Germany is the home of these small molecule ligands, so I'm sure Axel probably has more experience than us.
Absolutely.
So can we ask you that question first of all? You know, when you're staging newly diagnosed patients, especially these ones you maybe suspect might have metastatic prostate cancer, higher PSAs, high grade, you've had the biopsy report back. What's the approach in Germany in 2024?
I mean, I think we really want to have the best reliable imaging, and I think we should all work by the guidelines recommendation, which suggests to use in high risk and intermediate high risk situation Gleason 7B, PSA greater than 10, a PSMA PET. I mean, it's nothing more frustrating when you do a radical prostatectomy, patient comes back three months later with a detectable PSA, dropped maybe to one or two, and you know something is still in there. You did a good lymphadenectomy, but you have relied the surgery on conventional imaging, and when you do a PSMA PET scan then and find metastatic disease, and it can be just two or three bone lesions, you know that the prostatectomy would have been a mistake. Mm. So I think modern imaging in this situation really has a place, and PSMA PET is in the guidelines, and we are fighting for reimbursement. It's not fully reimbursed, and sometimes a fight with the insurance companies, but I think it's worthwhile to write a letter and to show the insurance what the evidence and what we should do.
Axel, you know, there's always this sort of confusion, because if you are looking to see whether the patient has got metastatic disease, absolutely, we know that PSMA PET has better accuracy than conventional imaging at staging these patients. But what about someone who comes in and you know they've got metastatic disease? It's clear. Mm-hmm. What kind of staging imaging do you use? Do you still rely on a PSMA PET, or do you say, well, we just want to know if they've got bone mets and their PSA is 700? So, do you go back to conventional imaging at that time?
I think in the setting and keeping like the European and German reimbursement situation, I think conventional imaging would still work. Mm-hmm. But you have published and shown us that also like the radiation dose is less, and it's a one-stop shop with a PSMA PET. And you don't have to schedule 2 days of imaging with a bone scan at the CT. So we try to do it. But on the other hand, for guiding the therapy, for doing the follow-up, I think it would be reliable, what you said, a PSA of 700, you don't need to see every bone metastasis. Mm-hmm. The other thing is, when it comes to, we have the low volume, high volume, we have the high risk, low risk, and I think this needs an update. Mm-hmm. This needs a major update, maybe like in kidney cancer, where you have good prognosis, intermediate and poor, according to five factors, or even mm-hmm. more in the IDMC classification. I think something like this, including Gleason, including maybe PAM50 or some other molecular markers, including more. And I know like a lot of people are working on that. So maybe the future we have more accurate groups. But until then, we have to rely on what we have. And I think here in the metastatic setting, a conventional imaging is not a mistake. Mm. Also for follow-up, for staging. Only exception when you plan to give radioligand therapy. I think this is good. You need a positive signal to have this mode of action work in your patient. So I think this is important. And I mean, there are indications like what we just talked about. And then there are indications where I think it doesn't make sense, like non-metastatic CRPC. We've discussed this, Dekton, the other day. Don't do PSMA imaging, because conventional imaging is enough to give one of the three drugs approved.
Yeah. I think it's still fair to say in very many places around the world, conventional imaging is the standard of care. So people listening and looking at this podcast will do that. And I suppose all that recent data, trials that you've been involved with of these novel therapies are all very dependent on that. So maybe let's focus on that for a few minutes and let's think about a few cases. And it was really encouraging at this meeting we've just been at, and I'm sure it'll be the same at EAU and DGU, other meetings this year. We see a lot of focus on educating urologists, and I'm sure at radiation oncologists, about these novel therapies. You know, how do you use them? How do you select patients? What are the toxicities, etc.? So that's what we'd like to do over the next few minutes, is trying to educate ourselves and our audience about that. Use some practical examples. So, and we had some case discussions in USANS recently. But let's say, for example, the 68-year-old patient who comes in with a PSA of 35. He's got an abnormal feeling prostate. He's had an MR that's abnormal, and now he's had a biopsy showing extensive grade group 4 Gleason 8 prostate cancer. He has had a CT and a bone scan, and we see pelvic lymphadenopathy and, let's say, 4 or 5 bone metastases, mostly in the pelvis and a couple in the spine. We might consider him to be low volume for what that's worth by conventional imaging.
At high risk.
But high risk, you know. Forget about the fact that PET might show a bit more, because all this data from the pivotal trials is based on conventional imaging.
True.
And let's presume that he's in good nick. He's in good health otherwise. What's your approach to this patient in 2024?
I think there have been a lot of changes the last years. 8 years ago, this was really a landmark where Chris Sweeney presented the charted data, and we were all fan of giving those men docetaxel, regardless of disease and volume. Then this was the discussion to treatment intensify from then on. And we've seen recent data from Titan, from Arches, from Latitude, introducing abiraterone, enzalutamide, and apalutamide in this setting as doublet therapy. So you don't have to use the chemotherapy anymore, because doublet therapy has shown the same efficacy, and also including high volume risk disease, high risk, high volume, and regardless of the if it's synchronous or metachronous, regardless of the risk criteria, there was always a benefit in this doublet therapy. Mm. We don't really have a direct comparison, but we probably come to this, what's better, triplet or doublet. But ever since we've seen this data on NHT combinations, this really advanced the treatment. And I think this is a standard for, I would say, 85% of my men, and especially the one you presented with lymph nodes. We don't have an urgent need to cure this man. He won't die of the disease, even though we would have started just ADT monotherapy. We would have a three-year prognosis in median. Now, with those novel hormone combinations like apalutamide or enzalutamide, we have a good quality of life, good patient-reported outcomes, and an overall survival in the patient you presented from about, depending on the response, 8 to 10 to 15 years.
It's unbelievable, isn't it? And these poor men were all dead in 5 or 6 years in the old setting. So I think you've given us a clear message that the vast majority of these patients, and most, of course, they don't have visceral metastases, either, the vast majority. And certainly the case I gave you, it's ADT and an AR pathway inhibitor.
Axel, you mentioned one thing that does cause a lot of confusion among urologists especially, is that concept of synchronous versus metachronous. Mm-hmm. Do you approach them any differently? I mean, there's a lot of there's a lot of data out there that suggests, oh well, you know, you wouldn't consider chemo up front for metachronous, but maybe for synchronous you would. You know, so what are your thoughts, and do you approach those patients differently? Firstly, what's your definition?
I think the definition, I mean, synchronous is when you present with this metastatic, what you just described, Declan, the case with metastatic prostate cancer, PSA 50, 60, 80, and lymph nodes, bone metastasis, synchronous. Metachronous is, for example, when you have a patient with high-risk disease, you did radiation and did concomitant ADT, for example, and 2-3 years later, you see bone mets and rising PSA. Yeah. And what we know for sure, that in those synchronous de novo metastatic men, the prognosis is worse. That's what we know for, I don't know if we have to share it with a man and the carers, but I think this is what we need to take into account when planning the strategy of the treatment. And when you have this fit 55-year-old man with synchronous metastatic prostate cancer, liver metastasis, you know this gentleman will die of this disease when he's otherwise fit. So you have to see, what do you do? Do you do the all-in approach according to Arasense with darolutamide, triplet with docetaxel up front, and then just continue darolutamide? Or you start the more, I would say, user-friendly or maybe urology-friendly, because we are like, we grew up with the ADT. This is our field. Yeah. So I think this is something what we should not forget, because NHT doesn't change a lot. It was a little different when we had the abiraterone with PRET, where you remember we had to check the lab values, but with apalutamide or enzalutamide, there's basically not really a lot, even according to the prescription rules, what you have to check. So it's similar to ADT, but just boosting the efficacy and having a much better stabilization. So for me, as said, 85% of my patients, I would start with an NHT-ADT combination and then closely follow up, at least for the last 2 years. When they have an ultra-low PSA or very good PSA response, we are safe. And also for the high-volume synchronous metastatic man. And, I mean, what would you recommend your friend? We have no direct comparison. Or what would you have on yourself? I would start mild with a good efficacy and then sequence with docetaxel or other combination. We have PARPs now. We have carboxytaxel, we have radioligand therapy. So we have really like a lot to come. And so I think it's according to quality of life, a good solution to start with the NHT-ADT combination.
I love
it. Makes a lot of sense.
And also, you asked the question about high volume, low volume. There was a lot of focus on this back in those days when CHARTED came out, high volume, low volume stampede. But I think, honestly, it's all become much more simple now. And in my mind, if you have a patient who you believe will benefit from ADT, so that almost always means they've got some form of metastases, then you should always add an AR pathway inhibitor.
Yeah, it's as simple as that. That is the message.
They've got an indication for ADT, so I no longer really get caught up in wondering, is this high volume or low volume by conventional imaging, by novel imaging, higher risk, low risk, all these things that emerged a few years ago. While they can be prognostic and give us some idea, we've seen, especially in that lovely paper you published in the European Journal of Cancer just a few months ago, you out of the Titan study, which was the upfront study with apalutamide. Correct. You've now looked at subgroups within it.
Yes, we looked at those subgroup analysis. Yeah.
And everybody benefits.
Yes, definitely.
So I think that's a really important, simple message. If you're out there, you're a urologist, we are the people who tend to diagnose these patients. True. I no longer have to get caught up in high volume, low volume, conventional, blah, blah, blah. If this is a metastatic patient in good health who I think I'm going to offer ADT, I'm always thinking straight away AR pathway inhibitor. And then we can have a discussion about which one, but I don't think it matters at all now.
Yeah, so aside that, I mean, you should, and that's what we also do in our prostate cancer clinics, that we discuss the patients in the multidisciplinary tumor ward. I think this is fair. And so the radonc, the medical oncologist, could give their input. For example, for your case, if I would be a radiation oncologist, I would, because it was, I think, if I recall correctly, low volume and high risk, but here we have a benefit of radiation to the prostate.
Mm. So yes.
Don't forget to include medical oncologists and radiation oncologists, nuclear medicine experts. I think we can all benefit, and especially the patient.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that is the benefit of working within a big multidisciplinary team, is that you have very easy access to all of these people who can help with that patient care. But the beauty of having these NHTs available is that these patients can still remain in the realm of the urologist's ability, can't they?
True.
It's very easy.
In fact, our colleague Nathan Lorenzo did a good talk at the USENS meeting where he was challenging this term NHT, which is novel hormonal therapy. He said, these have been around for ages. Oh, they're super hormonal therapies, but they're not novel. Can we? True. So I thought that was a good point as well.
That's true.
So I think that's very clear to us. ADT plus an AR pathway inhibitor. And then you also mentioned, what about adding the radiotherapy? So in my mind, this triplet discussion, and we'll talk about chemo in a second, is I also then think, I've started them on this, and the next question is this a patient who's also likely to benefit from some radiotherapy to the prostate? And that doesn't have to be immediately. Stampede, RMH did do that and showed that these lower volume patients, not the ones with extensive bone metastases, have a benefit. So I think that's the triplet to add in.
I think it's clinically relevant because the overall survival benefit, correct me if I'm wrong, but it was about 30%
yes.
to the radiation.
And well tolerated.
Yeah.
In the select patients,
so
yeah.
I think that's the triplet of choice. But before we move off this topic, I want to ask you about classic triplet. If we're listening to our medical oncology conferences, they're talking about adding in chemotherapy. That's what people tend to think of as triplet. I think triplet is radiotherapy or not, because there is no evidence, Axel, am I right, that if you're starting your patient on ADT and an AR pathway inhibitor, that adding docetaxel to that patient will improve survival or improve their quality of life? The studies that have tested triplets, Arisons and Piece 1, didn't add docetaxel to the ARP doublet. It had docetaxel and ADT, and it was adding the AR pathway inhibitor. And it showed that, yes, adding an AR pathway inhibitor to your initial docetaxel helped. But because that now almost never happens, at least in countries where you can access an AR pathway inhibitor, I struggle to think of too many circumstances where we can say to our patients, I think you'll benefit from adding the docetaxel now. But my medical oncology friends get a bit wound up about that.
It's a big discussion, and I was listening to a very smart urologist who said that is intentional data showing this. So meta-analysis, and the smart urologist is sitting on your left. Declan, I had a big discussion with a well-known medical oncologist. I think my big take-home message out of RSNs and Piece 1 is, don't give just the doublet docetaxel and just ADT, what we've learned 8 years ago from Chris Sweeney's data. So if you give chemotherapy, combine it with an NHT. I think this is a big take-home message everybody should not forget. And it's not within all heads. It's not like common knowledge that still some just give docetaxel and ADT. And I think this nowadays, after triplet data, is a mistake. The question, what is better? Even in high-volume, high-risk disease, as said, I think it's safe to start with a doublet nowadays, and you have the PSA, you see how the PSA responds. If you have an ultra-low PSA response, which can happen even in high-volume disease, good response in imaging, it wasn't a mistake. If something happens, if a PSA doesn't go down or
you
imaging...
develop visceral mets, then... Yeah.
And so far, we haven't seen any data that the one or the other is superior. So, a point of discussion.
Yeah.
Now, before Renu goes on to ask you about high-risk surgery patients, because we want to pick your brains on, best management of these patients we're considering for prostatectomy, but high-risk features or indeed radiotherapy, I want to ask you about PSA responses in these AR pathway inhibitors, because the other nice paper, the data from that paper in European Journal of Cancer, did show that if you start your patient on ADT and apalutamide and the Titan series, if you had these really, really spectacularly deep responses in PSA terms, it seemed to be associated with a considerably better outcome. Because and so it reinforced to me, we should actually watch how much these PSAs are dropping very carefully. Not just your PSA is well down, but is it like ultra low?
And also the timing of the PSA drop. If it's correct. An early drop, it yes. seems to confer yes. a better right. prognosis.
Definitely.
So can you give us a few messages about that? Yeah.
Yeah, that was the ESMO presentation. It's a sub post hoc analysis from the Titan trial. Mm. And first that published this was Simon Chowdhury, who looked at 0.2 and less as the cutoff point. But now we were able to really dig deeper and looked at what happens to the ultra-low 1 and ultra-low 2. It's a little hard to explain, especially in a podcast, but this ultra-low 2 is when the PSA drops to less than 0.02. Mm-hmm. So really undetectable. And some labs even struggle. We initially had to request from the lab, please give us the correct value and not something like it's less than 0.2, but we really want to have the value. And it works. They gave us. And this correlates with, as you said, when it drops very fast at 3 months or 6 months, the prognosis is much better. And if you look at those patients in the ultra-low 2 situation, they have, after 5 years, 10% died. So 90% of the men are still alive. Mm. Whereas in the patients that never went less than 0.2, 50% after 3 years died. So I think the other way around, with those ultra-low PSA responses, you are safe. You have a good, you can communicate with your patient. Everything is safe. And then they start, hey, when can we stop the therapy? That's another topic.
Yeah. Yeah.
But the ones that don't have this ultra-low PSA response, so what are we doing with them? We have to keep the eyes on them and do imaging more frequently, look at the PSA more frequently, and if something happened, go into hereditary testing and second-line therapy.
Very good.
Right. Are you also always checking their testosterone levels or only when their PSA starts to rise?
Yes, in clinical trials. Yeah. Yes, I should also in clinical practice. I don't do every time. I do every time when there's a progression or a sign of progression, and I should do every time, because it makes sense.
Yeah. And what about radioligand therapy, Axel? Because, we were moving, lutetium PSMA earlier and earlier in the disease spectrum, and, we're gathering some data, Arun's trial, Arun Azad's trial, the upfront trial is looking at the role of lutetium PSMA.
PSMA-4, same setting.
Right, exactly. Yeah. What's happening back home?
Yes, back home we have the label for a patient that had NHT and docetaxel or is not eligible for docetaxel. So it's a pretty broad label in this last, I would say, couple years for men with mCRPC. And it's still 2 to 3 years in this situation after you had a failure of chemotherapy and NHT. This is like the hardest to treat patient population, I have to say, because we don't have a lot of options. And I think with radioligand therapy with PSMA, we really have another option, which is, according to the data published here from your institution, Michael Hoffman, is better tolerated than carboxytaxel with the same overall survival benefit. So you really have a good option. Whether or not it competes against NHT, I wasn't quite convinced. Mm. We were suspecting to see the splash data now at ASCO-GU. However, it was cancelled last minute. Yeah. It was still in the book. You're an expert in lutectomy. It's definitely working on cancer cells, but we don't really know what timing in an early disease. So we should really work on trials where we compare standard of care with allowing all other options compared to lutetium.
Absolutely.
All right, Rune, you got a
high-risk prostate cancer.
5 minutes left.
5 minutes. That's going to be easy. Yeah, so your approach to high-risk, localized prostate cancer staging, your approach to these patients, a quick recap would be amazing.
Staging PSMA PET, yes, definitely. Clinical trial, perfect. Mm. We have clinical trials. I mean, what do we want to do? We want to cure this patient.
Yeah.
And we have surgery, and we have, on the other hand, radiation therapy. But is that enough? I always had the feeling not. And then we promoted, we do radical prostatectomy, and then we have surgical margins positive, we have at least 9 seminal vesicle invasions. So what do? Send to radiation oncology and do either early salvage, which is more in vogue nowadays, or an adjuvant therapy. But it's really tough to pick out the patient. So I think what is very new now, and it's tough to summarize within 5 minutes, but it's a perioperative or around the radiation treatment with NHT and ADT combinations. Mm. For example, the ProToys trial is looking at giving a half a year of ADT and apalutamide, then doing the surgery in both arms, and then ADT versus ADT and treatment intensification. So I think there is a role, and I've treated a couple patients where in this trial, the final pathology result found no tumor anymore. It was a Gleason 9 before high risk, localized, advanced, all course positive, and our pathologist called me, what happened? What did you do? And the tumor was gone. So I think this might be a future approach where when we grow up, I'm looking at you, Declan, not you, Renu, neoadjuvant therapy was totally out of discussion. Don't do that. It's hard to operate, but what we experience now, it's not hard to operate.
Yeah, I mean, we've just run the lutectomy trial of neoadjuvant lutetium PSMA, and I mean, we certainly saw the anti-cancer potential of lutetium PSMA. I mean, it's whether that leads to a long-term tumor-related response that's going to be the big question.
Did you combine with ADT?
No, we didn't, but Brian Chapin's trial is doing that out of MD Anderson. That is a combination of lutetium PSMA and ADT, because ADT does upregulate PSMA, so that's it'll be a very interesting trial when that happens.
Fantastic. Great to have you down here, Axel.
We could keep talking, couldn't we?
Yeah. Thanks for inviting me to your house, to your studio, to Australia. It has been a fantastic time.
So he does have to work tonight. It's a Wednesday evening here. We've just finished work for the day, but we're going to have to pack him up now. There are 60 or 70
people waiting for him.
Packed in and waiting for him in a nice hotel in the city centre to talk about this topic again. And thanks very much to our friends at Janssen for having you down here, Axel. It's been great to have you, of course. And they are gold partners of us here on the podcast. All our work is independent and clinician-led as usual, but we're very grateful to have such a wonderful key opinion leader here to talk about this great topic.
So good to have you, Axel. Enjoy the rest of your time in Melbourne.
Thanks a lot.